Well, one of the things I enjoy the most about this doing the show is the opportunity to feature Wisconsin authors. And it's always a pleasure to have New York Times bestselling author Jennifer Cheverini with us. She's back to talk about her fascinating new historical novel. You may know her, remember her work as from the popular Elm Creek Quilt series, but she's recently been writing many standalone historical novels that take us into the Civil War era. Her most recent is Christmas Bells. It weaves the story of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow with a very touching, up-to-date Christmas tale. And I really enjoyed reading it, and I'm pretty sure you will as well. You may have questions for her. You may be a fan of her books. Do you have a favorite? What gives you hope in times of strife? How do you deal with loss? Because loss is certainly a part of this book in many ways. Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. And Jennifer Cheverini, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you back. And I really did enjoy your book so much.
Thank you.
And it was inspired by the famous Longfellow poem. And, you know, I'm not sure that I have ever read the poem other than singing it.
That's right, yeah. To contemporary audiences, it's fair to say it's more familiar as the Christmas carol, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day.
Yeah, and so it was really fun, and I thought, well, how did you come to create a novel around this poem?
Well, I had heard the song, of course, and I had sung it around the holiday seasons for years. But it was in the course of researching some of my other Civil War era books that I was reminded that it did have the origin as this poem by Longfellow, who was arguably the most famous and celebrated and popular poet in America at the time. But I hadn't really noticed before that in the original source, in the poem, there are two stanzas that very directly talk about Longfellow's time and his circumstances. It was written in 1863 or 1864. Some scholars disagree about exactly when it was written. But it very specifically references the Civil War. We hear about the continent being split in two, and we hear the terrible roar from the cannons' mouths. But it's probably not surprisingly, those stanzas are left out in the carol that we sing today. And that, I always found that kind of curious and interesting, that his poem written to celebrate Christmas did so directly address these terrible circumstances that he was going through at the time. And I thought that it was a really fascinating poem, and I began to look more into it. It does begin, as you might expect, a Christmas poem to begin, by celebrating mm-hmm. the sounds of the season. Peace on earth, goodwill to men is a phrase that is echoed throughout the poem. But then it does something that we don't necessarily expect from a celebratory Christmas carol. He points out that in this season, when we're talking about peace on earth and goodwill to all, that you don't have to look around very far to see that that is not what's going on. You can see misery, strife, warfare, both in Longfellow's time and in our own. And then at the end of the poem, however, he says he hangs his head in despair. He says, there is no peace on earth. He points that out. He says, hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And yet, in the midst of this note of harsh reality, he calls forth this phrase, God is not dead, nor does he sleep. And that note of hope that resolves the poem really had a lot of resonance for me.
Yeah, and so the book itself, so half of the, I would say about half the book is his story,
right?
And then and his family story, and the other half is I would say very current.
Yes, very contemporary story. Well, when I first started writing Christmas Bells, I was planning for it to be just a historical novel alone, just mm-hmm. set in the past, because I was as I was fascinated by the creative process that he went through and learned more about it, I discovered that Longfellow wrote this poem not only in the midst of the terrible turmoil of war that he and his neighbors and people north and south were going through, but he was also enduring a very personal crisis. He was, and I don't want to give too much away for people who might want to enjoy the book on their own, but he was enduring personal mourning, personal deep tragic loss unrelated to the war. And it amazed me that even when he was in the midst of his own sorrow, he managed to come forth with this poem that is very life-affirming, very faith-affirming, and offers hope to his readers. So even in the midst of his own grief, he was able to write something that offered hope and encouragement to other people. And I really marveled at that. I thought that was a wonderful creative thing to do, a wonderful gift to offer to his fellow human beings. And I really wanted to understand who was the person who has this gift, not only the poetic gift, but the incredible gift of giving to others, to be able to, even writing from a place of sorrow, was able to offer hope to other people. And so it was just going to be about Longfellow and his life and his family and his creative process. But then my editor pointed out to me that it would be very important to show to my readers why this poem is still so important today, why it resonates with readers even in our modern era, a poem written so long ago in a very particular point in history. Why does it still have meaning for us today? And so that's why I wanted to bring in the contemporary story. These are all people who have been drawn together by Longfellow's work in our own day, and the poem speaks to each of them a little bit differently, but very profoundly nonetheless.
It certainly does. And I have to say, I as I went from one chapter to the next, I was always like, oh, well, we're back to the other story. This is so good. And then I'd be, to be honest, I'd be kind of sad at the end of the chapter because I wanted to keep on with that. But then it was always a delight to start again with the other story.
Oh, good, good.
I'm really glad you wove the two stories together. Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, talking with her about her latest book. It's called Christmas Bells. It's published by Dutton, and we have a link up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Of course, that book's going to be available at any of your bookstores or online. If you want to take another look at it, though, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. If you have a question or comment for her, maybe you're a fan of her books, have a question about them or about this particular book, join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post your questions or comments there. You know, this is in a way an aside, I think, of the book. But as I was reading about Longfellow and his family, I was thinking, you know, I don't think a poet, I mean, at that time, he made some money.
Yes, he was very successful in his career. Absolutely. He was a celebrity author, and he had a lot of wonderful, famous friends. He also worked for quite a lot of his career at Harvard as a professor of modern languages. So he was, of course, very well-read, very well-traveled, and was very popular and successful in his publishing career, and really enjoyed all the fruits of that success. He had a wonderful home. He was a devoted husband and father, and was celebrated for his wonderful wine cellar and his entertaining. And up until this point, before he wrote this poem, he really had been very, very blessed.
Very blessed. And, I wondered at the time as I was reading it, as you were writing about his love of his wife, or before they were married, and all of the things he tried to do.
Yes.
How much of that, was there any of that true?
Oh, yes, that's true. There were more potentially embarrassing details that Mr. Longfellow would perhaps not want known. He adored his wife, well, his wife, his wife, Frances. Her nickname was Fanny. He adored her for a long, long time. He had been married before, and he lost his wife in childbirth, and it was deeply devastating. And so he was traveling abroad to try to get away from his sorrow, in addition to pursuing his scholarly interests. And that is where he met Fanny. And she was going through some personal grief of her own. And they were drawn together by this mutual need for consolation and friendship at times when both were suffering loss. And for Henry, it became a much more stronger feeling than perhaps Fanny was feeling. And he adored her from a distance and tried to get her interested. And he became the butt of a lot of jokes in Boston society when they were all back over in the United States. But after some time, he did manage to win Fanny over, and she agreed to marry him after a lengthy courtship. And they were very, very happy. They were very happily married.
Yeah. Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, as we talk with her about her latest book. It's called Christmas Bells. And I'm having a lot of fun doing it, talking with her. And I'll join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234. Give us a call. The other half of the book, we sort of zeroed in mostly on Longfellow, rightfully so, I guess. But the talk about the other side of that. There are a lot, actually, in this book, it seems to me that there are more characters. You weave a lot of stories.
Well, we have quite a few narrators in the contemporary half of the book. The chapters do alternate. I show Longfellow's history, and I alternate those with chapters for people in the present day who are responding to his work. And I mentioned that it was my editor's suggestion that I do bring in this perspective to show how the poem is still relevant to people today and why it still has meaning for us. And I admit, I agree that was a great idea, but I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do that, how I was going to bring in that contemporary perspective. But I had this happy accident where inspiration came to me. My youngest son, Michael, sings with Madison Youth Choirs, and I was waiting outside the hallway of the room where they rehearse and waiting to pick him up to bring him home. And all of the boys in Britain in the choir were singing to prepare for a winter concert that was coming up. Now, they weren't singing I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, but as I listened to them, and they're absolutely, all of the Madison Youth Choirs are absolutely wonderful, and when you have an opportunity to hear them, you certainly should take advantage of it. It's a wonderful organization. And I was listening to them sing, and as I heard them singing this song that was ancient music from so long ago, I was reminded of how music has the power to speak to us, not only from different, crossing geographic boundaries and across generations and all kinds of demographics, but it really can speak to us across the centuries. When you hear a piece of music, you can understand what the composer was trying to convey, what emotions, what feelings, or what he or she was trying to evoke in the listener. And I think our best literature and our best poetry has the power to do that too. But I was really inspired by the music, listening to these young singers perform. And so I decided that the way to bring these two eras together would be to focus on the poem in Longfellow's day, but to focus on the carol in the present day. And so just as different people are drawn together to enjoy the music of Madison Youth Choirs here in our city, in my story, I show how a lot of different people are brought together around the performing of I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. We hear from two of the young singers who are in the choir. We also hear from their choir director, their mother. We hear from the accompanist, and then other people who are there. This is a church choir that's performing, and just people who are drawn together, brought together at this moment to enjoy this piece of music and how it speaks to each of them. And I think I really wanted to try to capture how music does that for us anytime we attend any kind of live performance.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, author of many books. How many books?
This is my 25th novel.
Wow.
Yes.
Her 25th novel, and she's been on the show for several, not all of them, but many
Yes,
of
and
them.
It's always wonderful to be here with you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. You may have questions for her. Again, join us at 1-800-642-1234. Jennifer Cheverini, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Chris Molina, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Net as we talk with Jennifer Cheverini about her latest book, Christmas Bells. Always great to have her along. And again, join in. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You have a lovely quote from Senator Paul Barrett, I think, who is... we won't go into that particular role, but the quote is, humanity's most precious commodity is time, not love, not because it's less important, but because you can run out of time while love can be endlessly replenished.
Yes, yes. He's one of my contemporary characters, and he and his wife are important benefactors of the church where the choir gathers, and he has enjoyed hearing the choir perform, and his wife, who is one of my narrators, is dealing with some loss of her own, very much like Longfellow was experiencing, and she goes through quite a transformation in the course of her chapter.
And you think this holds true, his statement?
Yes, I actually do. I do think that's true. I think, you know, because it sounds almost cliche, but the more love you give away, the more you get back in return. Whereas for each of us, time is precious and it's finite. And that's something that Longfellow learned very well when he was going through personal turmoil in his life. He wanted time to hold still in these wonderful, precious moments that he enjoyed with his family. And also, I think he wanted his children, particularly his sons, to stay young, not to get old too fast. Because when war came to Boston, his two eldest sons, Charlie, his eldest boy, they were like so many young boys. They were excited and thrilled with all of the martial pomp and circumstance, and they admired all of their heroes, all the older boys who were able to march off to war. And Charlie absolutely wanted to go. He wanted to enlist, and it was Longfellow's great relief that he was, at the start of the war, too young to enlist. And everyone thought that it was going to be over in 90 days. It'll be over in time. And in fact, that's the original enlistment, only asked for volunteers for 90 days because President Lincoln and all of his advisors believed that they would be able to put the insurrection down within 3 months. And so Longfellow and his wife were counting on everything to be done and finished and settled before their own sons would be exposed to any danger. But as we all know, that is not at all how it worked out. And with each passing year, Charlie grew older and older, more likely to be able to be to enlist or to be drafted, and ever more eager to fight for his country, to fight for the North.
Yeah. I was going to talk about what Brian had to say on Facebook, but before we do that, this is your fifth, I think, standalone novel on the Civil War, and I really enjoyed. Well, I enjoyed them all. I think Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker was a bestseller, New York Times bestseller for sure, among others. What is it about this period, and we've talked about this before, but tell us, what is it about this period that you continue to be fascinated with?
Well, there are two answers to that. The first is that while I'm researching and writing one novel, I usually come across a historical figure or a fascinating historical event that inspires me so much that I think, oh, I've got to file that away because that, I really want to write another book about that. So that will be my next topic. And so while I'm writing about the Civil War, I tend to encounter more fascinating historical figures from that period. But also, the Civil War was such a fascinating, transformative period for our nation. We see both the best and the worst of what we are as Americans thrown into stark relief. We see examples of unimaginable atrocities right next to heroism and people making incredible sacrifices to help other people. And the nature of that conflict and what it could have meant to our country if things had turned out differently, it holds endless fascination for me, and it's very, very rich with storytelling potential.
And when you research these, I know so much of the book, even though they're novels, your books have a lot of events that actually happened, and the way you describe them. Where does your research primarily take place? Is it online? Do you go with?
Well, I do quite a bit of research online. I'm very fortunate that one of my favorite research sources, period newspapers, many of them have been digitized, so I can look online and I can see what my characters would have been learning, especially when my characters are in Boston and their loved ones are off fighting in the Civil War. Communications were very difficult, and often they relied upon newspaper reports, which were sometimes accurate, sometimes erroneous. And so by being able to read papers from the 1864, 1863, that gives me a very good sense of what my characters would have been experiencing in that moment, mm-hmm. as opposed to something, a more historical text that analyzed everything from the advantage of 100 years of hindsight. I also do a considerable amount of my research at the Wisconsin Historical Society. They have wonderful archives on everything for helping me to set the scene to investigating individual characters that I decide to use as fictional, historical figures that I use as fictional characters in my book. So that's a wonderful resource that I tap into with all of my historical fiction.
Yeah, I like how you describe it, too. You describe it as a work of fiction inspired by history.
Yes, I do try to get my historical facts correct, but there are limits to the historical record. I refer to historical newspapers. Well, they weren't always accurate. Sometimes there were honest mistakes made in the reporting. Sometimes maybe a little editorial slant thrown in. And of course, a reporting of the same event would look very different to someone writing for the New York Times as opposed to someone writing for the Richmond Examiner. So that didn't, of course, influence what I'm able to read today.
So you, and how much embellishment of history do you allow yourself for?
I try not to take too much liberty with the historical record. I won't move a Civil War battle, for example, because it would be more convenient for me to have the Battle of Gettysburg in 1861. I won't do that because I want to work within a framework of something that could have happened, even if I don't know that it actually happened. However, there are limits to the historical record. We don't know what people said in private moments. We don't know what people were feeling, those kind of sensations. Yeah. So when you have those interior thoughts, those private conversations that aren't part of the historical record, those I had to invent. There's no other way to get them. But I think that's part of what makes historical fiction so wonderful to write and so enriching to read, that although it's not the straight historical record, which there are gaps, there are limits to that, it does give a reader the opportunity to really experience what it might have been like to be in those times, to be going through these experiences by putting you inside the perspective of that character, of that narrator. And that, I think, is the great gift of historical fiction, is it really, to the extent that literature can, it lets you experience another life in another time and place.
I really enjoy historical fiction for that very reason. It's just so much fun. And I think, you know, as I you know, I'm pretty familiar. I've read a lot on the Civil War, for example, and I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the characters and so forth. But and as I read your dialogue, I think, you know, that's probably, I mean, that's a pretty good guess as to what that person might have said or what that person might have been feeling.
Well, I do try to be true to what I know about the historical person when I am imagining the life that was not documented. In Longfellow's case, he left journals. He had many letters. And so I was able to read those in addition to his incredible body of poetic works. But his letters, the drawings that he would make for his children, all of these wonderful artifacts of him, not only as a poet, but as a husband and father and friend, helped me to get a sense of what he was like as a man, what he was like as a person. And I tried to remain true to that when I was imagining conversations he had with his children, confrontations he had with his son Charlie, when Charlie was asking for his blessing to enlist in the Union Army. I tried to hold true to what I knew of him from his letters and from his journals when I imagined how he would have responded to Charlie as a father.
You must spend a lot of time on researching these books.
I do, but I really enjoy it. To me, it's like historical detective work to go through all these wonderful archives and to go through these letters and to imagine what it would have been like to have been there and to have experienced these historical events and this incredible turmoil as these people did.
And, you know, loss is kind of a key theme in this particular novel, and without going into
many spoilers.
Yeah. So is that a theme that you know, consciously, all right, I'm going to talk about loss?
Well, it was something that was certainly overwhelming in Longfellow's life at this time. He had enjoyed a wonderful writing career, but when he came upon this profound moment of loss in his life during wartime, he thought that he would never write again. He was so exhausted from grief and mourning that he wrote in some letters that he struggled to find the words. He felt like there was nothing he could say anymore. He had nothing left. He had been exhausted. And as someone who loved to write, as someone who had been inspired and inspired others with his poetry and his other work, this was quite a devastating blow. It was a second grief. It was a second loss. And with the encouragement of loving friends and devoted family, he tried very hard to come back from this. And when he found himself incapable of composing any original works of poetry, he turned to translation. He felt that this was something he had done in the past. As a professor of languages, he felt it was very important to introduce these works that he cherished in other languages to an American audience. And so just to give himself something to, you know, to get out of bed in the morning. Of course, he was still devoted to his family, but to give himself a reason to keep going, he turned to translating Dante's Divine Comedy. And this was something he worked. He would go to the beauty of the Italian language. He found a lot of comfort and solace in the beauty of that poetry and in the mission of introducing this via translation to American readers. And, of course, his friends were thrilled that he was working again, that he was taking up his pen and he was working. And so he had this circle of friends who would gather at his home, and they were there to support him both through his time of mourning, but also in his creative work. And so he would read what he had recently translated. They would offer their critiques, and he would make changes. And then the next time they gathered, he would do the same. And this small group of friends became the Dante Society, which is still thriving with us now in the 21st century.
It's absolutely amazing. And for him, I think putting pen to paper, And the process of, even though they're not your own words, just probably turned it around for him.
And it certainly did.
To some extent.
Right. And then there's a question, too. He might have thought, I'm not being creative, I'm only translating. But of course, he's making all kinds of creative choices. He is composing poetry. But I think it was a way for him to regain this art form that he thought he had lost along with all the other losses he had been experiencing.
And you do write in the book, and Brian, we'll get to your comment and a question in a minute, but you do write in your book about the many important thinkers of the day that came to, is it Craig House?
Craigie House,
Craigie
yes.
House.
Yes, of course, now we know it as Longfellow House, but at the time, it went by the name of its previous owners and the people that the Longfellows had purchased it from. And it's still there, Craigie House or Longfellow House. It's still preserved. It's a museum to Longfellow. It holds a lot of information about his works, not only as a scholar and a poet, but also his works of fighting for abolition. And he was not the first illustrious person to have lived within that house.
Yeah.
In fact, when he was there, he thought of it not so much as this is going to become the famous Longfellow House, but it was better known for one of his predecessors. This house in Cambridge, this beautiful mansion in Cambridge, was actually home to George Washington and Martha Washington. During the siege of Boston, George Washington came to mm-hmm. take command of that part of the Continental Army, and he lived in that house, and it was his headquarters for several months throughout the siege of Boston. And so at that point, that's why the house was celebrated. Now, of course, it's preserved by the National Park Service as a tribute to both of those famous Americans.
And you did write a little bit about the George Washington tie-in. Did you visit you visited the home?
I could not. I wanted to. I could only visit it virtually, which is why I am especially indebted to the National Park Service, not only for preserving the house, but also for having wonderful online archives for me to go through.
Well, Brian wonders if you have readings and signings planned for Christmas Bells.
I do. I'm going to be at Books and Company in Oconomowoc on Wednesday, November 11th. I'm going to be at Anderson Books, two doors east at their gift shop in Naperville on the Sunday after Thanksgiving. And then I'm also going to be making a return visit to the Velveteen Rabbit Bookshop in Fort Atkinson on Saturday, December 5th. And all of that information is on my website at jenniferscheverini.com or on my Facebook page, Jennifer Cheverini Author. So I certainly hope to meet lots of readers at those events.
Oh, absolutely. And I believe we have, Chris, have we got those dates up? Chris says, we got those dates up. So they're on our Facebook page as well. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show and you'll get a link to Jennifer's sites and also the information that she has there. Well, the book itself, again, I just want to say how much I enjoyed it. What a perfect timing, I think, for the book, too, obviously. What your next book, well, before we go to that, what do you want readers to take away from this particular book?
Well, I hope they'll take inspiration, as I did, from Longfellow's ability to find hope in not only his creative works, but in his friends and in his family, and to look beyond his own grieving and to be able to offer hope to others. I think ultimately that is what helped him overcome his losses, by being able to think not only inwardly, but also to turn out and to offer to others the comfort and solace that he himself needed very much. You mentioned earlier the quote from the character, the senator in the novel, about time and love and how they're both important resources, but time is finite, love is inexhaustible. I think that Longfellow, too, felt that in his life, that being able to reach out and offer to others the comfort that he himself so badly needed, it was a way of finding peace, finding resolution, and finding hope for himself. And I hope that if anyone, this is a very difficult time of year to be going through loss, to be dealing with grief. And whether it's the loss of a loved one or some other kind of sorrow, because the pressure is on us to be merry and to have a good Christmas and to have a happy Thanksgiving. And for those of us who are going through challenging times, as Longfellow did, as some of the other characters are doing, then we feel this additional pressure that we have to forget our griefs and our troubles and make things happy and be happy. And I found that even if you can't change that feeling, if you can comfort others and offer help to others, it is a way to renew that sense within yourself.
And I'm certainly thinking if you are going through, if someone is going through times of maybe a little time of stress, this is, even though it talks a lot about loss, I think it's a wonderful read for someone like that, but frankly, for anyone. It's was really a wonderful book. You have plans for your next book is in the works, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's in the work. It's another historical novel, and we don't have a title for it yet. We do have a publication date. It'll be out on September 13th of next year.
Okay.
And it focuses on John Wilkes Booth, the man who assassinated
really
President Abraham Lincoln. But he's very important, of course, but really we learn about him through the perspectives of four women who were very important to him in his life. We tend to think of John Wilkes Booth as just this madman who suddenly appeared on the scene on that Good Friday, that terrible night when he assassinated Abraham Lincoln. But he was a person. He was a man who had people who loved him, who had people who cared about him, and their lives were intertwined with his. And I wanted to try to understand, how does someone go from being this beloved brother, this cherished son, to being the most hated man in America in the wake of this terrible act? So we see him throughout his life from the perspectives of four women who are absolutely crucial to him. They were dearest to him. We see him from the perspective of his mother, from his favorite sister, Asia. We see him from through the eyes of his sweetheart, who was a senator's daughter and a unionist, a northerner, who really was very admiring of President Lincoln and had no idea that John Wilkes Booth felt differently than she did for a long time. And then, of course, we also see him through the eyes of the woman who was convicted as his co-conspirator, Mary Surratt. So we see the evolution of this infamous individual through the view of these four women.
Well, you'll be back to talk about that with us, I'm sure.
I would love to. Thank you.
In the meantime, it's a great pleasure to have you in to talk with us about Christmas Bells. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Jennifer Cheverini is the author of Christmas Bells. It's published by Dutton, and I highly recommend it to you, and I hope you have a chance to look at it. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You'll get links to her sites and also to the book itself. So really glad to have her back, and she'll be with us again, I'm certain, when that next book comes out. I'm already eagerly awaiting that one. And I'm looking forward to our next guest as well. Almost anywhere you go, you probably see kids, well, not only kids, but adults glued to their phones or tablets or whatever. And we're going to talk about some of the issues about that technology. There's the author, one of the authors of the book, Unplug, Raising Kids in a Technology-Addicted World. I have a 12-year-old that I have some good questions for our next guest based on experience. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.